Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is James Petras. It's always great to have Jim back. Jim, I know there's a lot on your mind. Let me just begin briefly by mentioning, I haven't really dug into this, I just saw the report briefly, this morning's so-called jobs report. Well, consensus, I believe, called for a couple of 100,000 jobs created. Of course, they're not mostly the kind of jobs people want to have. You know, washing dishes, sweeping floors, waiting on tables, stuff like that. The good, high-paying jobs really don't exist for most people. And it's the rotten ones that a couple of generations ago, the people who are taking these jobs absolutely would have shunned them. Well, it was a shocker this morning. 74,000 jobs created. 74,000 mostly rotten jobs. I'll take a closer look at it. I don't know whether I'll write about it this time or not, Jim. I've written about jobs numbers, monthly jobs reports before. I don't want to do it every month. But this one certainly surprised some people. It surprised me because it's very easy to manipulate the numbers and make them to come out any way the Labor Department wants. And even the Labor Department, Jim, admits that their reports are accurate to the degree of something like several hundred thousand plus or minus. So maybe we lost 300,000 jobs instead of gaining 74,000. Anyway, it shows what I say so many times in so many of my articles, that it may be high times on Wall Street and other corporate boardrooms and for the war profiteers and for the millionaire members of Congress. I'm writing about that today. I've written about it before, but there's a new report out, Congress being a millionaire's club. It's not exactly new news, but they're richer than ever. I forgot what I wanted to say.
Well, Steve, the fact of the matter is that several hundred thousand new entrants into the labor market make that figure so paltry. That is, it's not even covering the people that are finishing school and looking for jobs. Moreover, they actually published this anomaly. They said the number of unemployed has declined. Yes. And then it mentions the fact that several hundred thousand people have dropped out of the labor market, which means effectively that after searching high and low for months at a time, they no longer register at the unemployment office because, first of all, their unemployment benefits have been cut off, and secondly, it's a waste of time. They keep going down to the unemployment office and there's no job. So in fact, we have a vast increase in unemployment, but it's not counted because they don't go downtown to register as unemployed. And in fact, I would say that the unemployed figure has increased. The recession is still in place. There's been no recovery as far as the vast majority of American working people, and all of the hoopla it operates within a very narrow circle of the media, Wall Street, and the government officials in charge of economic policy. So I think most people realize that these figures are fraudulent. No one really trusts the government or the mass media, particularly as in response to the headline news about economic dynamism and economic growth. It's pure, unadulterated BS.
Well, it sure is, Jim, and the point I wanted to make really is what you just emphasized, that for the majority of people in America, there is a very severe, protracted depression with a D going on. It's the worst since the 1930s. And in the 1930s, we had Franklin Roosevelt. Today, we have Barack Obama. And from 1934 or so to 1937, tremendous government jobs creation program cut the unemployment rate from 25% to 11%. And I've written, it's been a good while, but I remember writing about how this program literally built Chicago's lakefront. A huge undertaking, but of course it built important dams and bridges and roads and so on, put millions of Americans back to work. And now Obama is not a jobs creator. He's a jobs destroyer. And the jobs that are created are rotten ones.
Both Congress and the White House have a fixation on military activity in the Middle East. They're looking aside as Israel builds new Jews-only settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem. They're supplying arms to the Maliki dictatorship in Iraq. They're sending aid to the Syrian terrorists. They're still engaged in Afghanistan. And of course, these are directions in policy that don't generate jobs. They drain the treasury. They reduce the possibilities of restarting the U.S. economy. Whereas even Obama 2 years ago recognized that it's Asia where the pivot of the world economy operates, where China has displaced the U.S. as the world's biggest trader and manufacturer. When I talk about the turn to the Middle East, I'm not talking about U.S. multinationals relocating in that area. What I'm talking about is trade, and I think that this is an important distinction. I think trade with Asia should be the centerpiece of U.S. policy. But when I say trade, I don't mean investment. One of the big problems is that U.S. corporations are not investing here, and the money that they have here, they're hoarding it. There's trillions of dollars that have been stored up by the corporations looking at particularly speculative activity. But there's no lack of capital for investment. It's just being hoarded. The other side of the coin is that whatever government activity takes place, it's military activity in the Middle East. So instead of promoting large-scale trade agreements, I want to make that clear, not multinationals going abroad, not investment agreements, that would make a major impact on the U.S. economy, particularly in the manufacturing sector, where we have skilled workers, engineers, who can design products that can sell in Asia. And that has been a tremendous hole in U.S. economic policy. Wars in the Middle East, hoarding by corporations at home, bellicose bluster toward China, and overlooking the most significant opportunity, which is for the U.S. to get heavily involved in trade in the most dynamic area which would generate jobs in the United States, which is Asia, particularly China, India, South Korea, Indonesia. These are countries that have income. They're not stagnating like Europe. They're looking to purchase U.S. technology. They're looking for opportunities to upgrade their consumer goods. But this is not lacking because the financiers and the militarists really run U.S. policy and not people interested, really interested in trade and growth.
Well, there certainly is no growth on Main Street, as we both know, Jim, and it's the reason that so many people are suffering so much. And another point I would make is that if enough people drop out of the labor force, the way the model of calculating unemployment has been so corrupted over the years, in the 1980s, the model used then would show unemployment exceeding 23%. I mean, that's depression level. But if enough people keep dropping out because there simply aren't jobs, they can't find them, well, the Labor Department could at some point claim the unemployment rate is zero.
Yeah, that's right. Also, I think the clear indication of the inequalities in America, last year, any investor in equities and in stocks made between 25 and 30% on the U.S. government cheap money policy allowed all the big investors to reap one of the most lucrative years at the same time that salaries and wages declined at least 2% last year. So you get on one side the top 10% reaping 30% gains, just sitting on their butts clipping coupons, and the other 90% working and slaving and losing money.
Well, absolutely true. In my article on the Millionaires Club in Congress, I'm going to mention a long-standing canard in America that if all you have to do to get rich is to work long enough, hard enough. And of course, I mean that was a myth many, many years ago, and today it's more a myth than, I mean, really, it's a disgusting lie today because it simply doesn't happen. And people collecting food stamps or homeless people, Jim, are working people, but they have rotten jobs. They can't afford to pay the high rents. They can barely afford to feed their kids if they have families. If they're homeless, I don't know what the devil they do.
And, well, 22% of the children in the United States today, most of them minorities, but including poor whites, it's 22%, 21.9% of children are undernourished in the United States today. There's right across the street from my house, there's an elementary school where half the kids qualify for free meals, breakfast and lunch. And those are the major meals of the day, is state-subsidized school meals right here in upstate New York.
Well, that's right, Jim. And, same in Chicago. I'm not current on what the school meal program is, but the poverty in Chicago, inner city Chicago, especially among Latino and black families, these kids, they literally, if they didn't get a hot meal at school, they might not get one at all. That's how bad the conditions are. And there literally is no interest in them whatsoever. City policy, the big moneyed interests run Chicago just the way they run the country, and they simply don't care about these kids, and budgets are being cut, so whatever has been done, whatever is being done, is being slowly eroded over time, so it becomes less and less, and these people, poor people, desperate people, are being thrown to the wolves. And of course, Congress last November, I believe, November 1, I think it was, cut food stamps with plans to make more cuts ahead.
Well, Steve, I'd like to mention two subjects that I'm working on, recently writing on. One is the role of Saudi Arabia as a center of one of the big centers of international terrorism. As we all know, the Saudi billionaires and the so-called monarchy, which is a despotism, it's a family dictatorship that controls hundreds of billions of dollars. Under the intelligence director, a fellow named Bandar, bin Sultan, you have Saudi Arabia running a terror network that beheads victims in Syria. They're funding a civil war with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're wheeling and dealing with Pakistan and its intelligence agencies and the Taliban in Afghanistan. They're getting arms for the United States for funding terrorists that are killing U.S. troops. They have no qualms about signing secret agreements with the Israelis to support the Egyptian military dictatorship. They're trying to create civil war in Lebanon by extending $3 billion to the Lebanese army to fight the Hezbollah activists in the south of Lebanon, and yet nothing appears in the mass media. They're all on the take after whatever subsidies they get or whatever handouts they get or investments they make with the Saudis keeps their mouth shut about the fact that Saudi Arabia is one of the world's centers of terrorism, and the same pious leaders that proclaim a very rigid form of Islam, they are the biggest customers of the high-end call girls in New York, Washington, Paris, and London. They're a bunch of hypocrites. They're involved in terrorism. They deplete productive countries of enormous resources by covering over $100 a barrel of oil that goes into their own pockets. There's not a leadership which is more parasitic, more destructive of human lives. Saudi Arabia has killed more innocent people in the last 2 years than the entire operations of Bin Laden over two decades. And so what we have is this Bandar is a protege of Bin Laden on a bigger scale because he has the backing of billions of dollars of the Saudi despots. And no one talks about Bandar as one of the war criminals of the 21st century.
Well, there's no question in the world about that. The entire corrupt Saudi regime, from King Abdullah on down, I don't know how many princes there are, but the so-called royal family, there are lots of members in it. Bandar has had a number of jobs back in the senior Bush administration. You remember, Jim. He was very, very close to the Bush family, probably still is. And I recall seeing a picture of him at the White House with George Herbert Walker Bush, I think smoking cigars and drinking whatever they were drinking. And he had the nickname of Bandar Bush. And he's head of intelligence, Saudi intelligence now. I mean, he plans mass murder. So he's in charge of Saudi Arabia's Murder Incorporated.
And he got the Saudi family people out of the U.S. at the high security point because they were linked with some of the 9/11 terrorists. And the U.S. government allowed these accomplices or acquaintances of the terrorists to get out of the country under cover of U.S. Secret Services. And with the complicity of the White House, and this is going on today. It's one thing to say the Saudis were involved with the Bushes, but the Saudis are getting arms and protection from the 7th Fleet in the United States, the air bases in Saudi, to keep this dictatorship operating, and it's operating its terror networks. Any place in the world where a dictatorship emerges, a right-wing terrorist group emerges, especially in countries with Islamic population, the Saudis are surely there funding them, arming them, training them, and hiring ex-CIA people or current CIA people to train their terrorists to operate in areas of great interest to their citizens.
Well, there's no question about that. They're bankrolling the most radical elements waging war against the Syrian government. I've seen numbers on the order of up to 50,000 or so. And, you know, I mean, they can be eliminated. They can be killed or injured or whatever. And they can be, more of them can be recruited to replace them. I mean, I don't know how many jihadists on the lowest level there are, Jim. I guess there are lots of people that want to fight for whatever reasons they decide they want to do it, you know, a great afterlife or whatever it is. But these people are recruited by the thousands. They're sent into countries. The irony in the region, Jim. America supports these crazies in Syria, and the same crazies are fighting the corrupt Maliki government in Iraq, and America opposes them, of course. Wants to keep its puppet leader in charge.
And nobody looks at who's bankrolling these terrorists.
Well,
one
Saudi
thing
Arabia
to say
is
the
bankrolling
US
them.
Opposes these Al Qaeda, but who's bankrolling the Saudi government is paying its Al Qaeda opposition to go fight abroad. But of course, a lot of this is going to backfire. A lot of these terrorists that the U.S. is supporting in Syria, they're going to come home with arms, training, and cause mischief in the United States. They're going to cause terrorist incidents when they go back to Europe after this thing is over.
Well, indeed they will, Jim. They certainly will harm the Middle East. And, I mean, we're seeing it in one country after another, including in Lebanon. I mean, cross-border spillage is very easy. Lebanon shares a border with Syria, so does Iraq. So it's very easy for these crazies to cross the border. But, of course, we had Libya, the same thing going on. These people were recruited there. They've been shipped, I guess, Saudi money, paying to ship them to Syria and other venues where Saudi Arabia wants them. But they certainly spill cross-border into Somali, and they can, again, they can go anywhere, and you start recruiting these people, and then you recruit limitless numbers of them. I mean, you have a raging army of crazies going around committing mass murder and gross atrocities, and this stuff goes on. It gets no attention in the U.S. media, but it's going on. It could get worse. Well, I agree, Jim. If some of this stuff starts happening in European capitals in America, well, that will certainly get attention, but it won't be mentioned in the same context as what's going on in these other countries. I don't. This will just be part of the war on terrorism, you know, and they'll just call it homegrown terrorism or something or other, but it'll be because of these policies that America instituted, and Israel is very much involved in this, and it just gets as bad as it is, it just seems to get increasingly worse.
Well, Steve, on that vein, I'd like to comment on, you mentioned the influence that the pro-Israel lobby has in the United States. And recently, a very important piece of research was published in the Jewish Weekly called The Forward. I don't know if you came across it.
No, I don't think so.
But it listed the salaries of some of the major Jewish organizations. Now, as I mentioned it, I recalled in my youth, my younger days, when I was living in a very pluralistic working class neighborhood, that some of these organizations, like the Working Men's Circle, the Hadassah, these were charity groups that took care of the needs and worked with working class Jews that were interested in social welfare, self-improvement, education. They carried out important social functions, and many of the times, particularly the labor organizations, were working with anti-fascists. They opposed the McCarthyism. We were in the forefront of coalitions that were helping and working with working people of all religions and ethnic backgrounds. And now we have and their leaders weren't getting salaries much beyond what the average worker was getting. I remember the Hadassah selling raffle tickets in the fish store that I was working in to put beds in a hospital in Israel for Jewish refugees fleeing from Nazism. And now the head of Hadassah, a woman named Janice Weinman, gets $400,000 a year. The head of the Working Men's Circle, he's getting, Ann Toback is getting $185,000 plus perks. And there's been a change not only in the type of leaders now enriching themselves, but their politics. They're no longer interested in helping out-of-work school teachers, public employees, accountants that are having difficulty. No, their activities are directed toward promoting the Israeli state. It's the settlements in Palestinian territory. They've changed the whole nature from being organizations of social solidarity with poor working-class Jews to supporting a militarist state, and they do that in a way that alienates most of their original donors. In this article in The Forward, they have a comment section on the study of these salaries, and most of the Jewish readers are indignant. One guy calls them ganefs, which is a Yiddish word for thieves. And he says, I'd rather give money now to a beggar in the street than these guys that are lining their pockets. That's a direct quote. And I think what happened is the base of these organizations has shrunk. They don't depend on low-income donors anymore. They get a big grant from millionaires and billionaires who are Israel firsters. And in order to cater to that and their own big salaries, which resonate with the millionaires, they've turned the organizations into lobbying arms, political arms of the Israeli state. And this is really one of the big transformations. And it's alienated many of its old-time supporters and many of the young people that are coming up. Young Jews are not attracted to an organization which essentially has become an Israel-first industry. It's an industry that generates propaganda. It's an industry that buys congressmen. It's an industry that puts Israeli interests first and foremost on its political agenda. And this is a sharp contrast to what I remember as the working man's circle. My friends' fathers, a carpenter, house painters, were members of that circle, credit unions. They had summer camps. Well, that's all gone now. Now it's, breaking open champagne bottles with billionaires to send some kids to get brainwashed in Israel.
It's a very disturbing story, Jim, and especially to support a regime that's connected with what's going on in Washington and the combination of America and Israel. I mean, literally threatens humanity's survival. Both countries are heavily nuclear-armed with long-range missile delivery systems, all kinds of other
sophisticated
weapons.
But it wasn't always
weapons.
Like that, Steve. That's the point I'm making.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I don't know what it was like in Newton, Massachusetts, where you were growing up, but I remember in Boston.
Jim.
In Revere and Lynn, where I grew up, it was totally different. I lived about a block and a half from a building which was run by the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And I remember very poor peddlers spending the night there. People that were selling whatever, carrying it in briefcases, they'd stop there, pay a buck or two to get a bed, and get a minimum breakfast and go on their work. Now it's a money machine for its leaders who are getting six-digit and $200,000 salaries. It's all a big change, Steve.
It's all a big change. And when I grew up, there was no Israel until I was age 14. So I was bar mitzvahed a year before Israel was created. Of course, it was percolating toward being created at that time. I'm just an inner-city Boston kid, Jim.
Yeah.
But great memories from that. One year, my family moved to one of the Newton suburbs, and I spent 1 year there, but I didn't really spend it there. I was living at school at the time, and then my parents moved down to Florida to get away from Boston's cold. Anyway, it's a different world today, Jim, than it was back then. It sure wasn't perfect then, but it really scares the daylights out of me now, wondering whether humanity really will survive what's going on. I think it may end up a coin toss, literally, with the possibility that at some point we could see a nuclear war. There are people a lot smarter than me, Jim, who think that possibility is real. Certainly hope it doesn't happen. Heaven help us.
Well, I agree with you there, Steve. And I think we ought to recover some of the positive history of the past in our communities.
Oh,
there's a lot of alienated people there, and governments and these millionaire organizations that claim to speak for the great American public are outright liars. Most people
gotta cut you off. We're out of time.
Don't trust these organizations and our political leaders.
Jim, I look forward to more next month. We
certainly
agree,
Steve,
on this.
Okay, Steve, thanks for calling.
Keep up the good work. Join us over the weekend. 1 p.m. Eastern Time, make it a regular habit.